Expanding science literacy, not just for kids, but for everyone. The Maine Science Festival takes place this weekend in Bangor with more than 50 events in several locations. The idea is to celebrate science and highlight some of the research and technology happening in Maine, a positive message. But it's taking place during a time of concern for many scientists. They worry that there has been a shift in our culture against science literacy, that the public doesn't always understand what scientists do or the data they produce, and there is skepticism about their findings. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss the concept of science literacy and how science is a part of our everyday lives. We'll also discuss science education and some of the careers available in the field. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. We often hear about the importance of exposing children to STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math. And so many topics in the news center on science in some way, from climate change to medical advances to the foods we eat. But there still seems to be a gap and a need for better understanding and passion for science among the general public. Joining me to talk about this, three guests in our Bangor studio. Kate Dickerson is director of the Maine Science Festival, which is coming up in just a few days. Ruth Lyons is gifted and talented coordinator for RSU 22, which includes Hamden, Winterport, Newburgh, and Frankfurt. She has a PhD in educational psychology, concentrating in gifted education and educational leadership. And Susan McKay is the founder and CEO of Sarah Helix in Orono, a company that offers energy-efficient filtration technology, and she has a PhD in chemistry. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you in a science-related profession? Do you remember if there was something that caught your interest in science? Do you find science today too confusing and complex? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to all of you. Susan McKay, did I pronounce the name of your company correctly?
You did.
Oh, good. Sarah Helix. That's C-E-R-A. Sarah, yes. Yeah. So I'm going to start with you, Kate. The Maine Science Festival is approaching its third year. It's huge, 22,000 attendees. And someone might assume that this is something for kids, but you say, no, this is for everyone. What's the goal? Why do you want everyone to come learn about science?
Well, the fast answer is that science impacts everyone. So it's really important that kids get inspired by it, but also that adults understand how science is and why it's so important in our lives. And the other reason is because, you know, as great it is to have things for kids, the people who are making decisions nowadays are the adults. So if they don't understand how science works, it's going to affect everything from policy decisions to economic development to what schooling is important for their kids. So we're really trying to make sure that people of all generations understand science so that they can push Maine forward and just better understand the world around us.
Susan, in your career in science with a PhD in chemistry, do you find sometimes that you feel a disconnect between the scientists you work with and other people in your lives?
I'm not really sure how to answer that. No, I mean, I think it's definitely true that when I tell people I have a PhD in chemistry, that tends to end the conversation. So I think when you're in science, you probably do tend to be not discuss what you do as much with people outside of your field or outside of the job. So there is definitely that impact. I mean, sometimes you'll meet occasionally a person who's very interested and is like, oh, I love science. And then you might talk more about what you do. But in a day-to-day, it's correct. You know, I tend not to discuss what I do in my job with the people that I interact with.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because people are intimidated?
Yeah, I think people, science, unfortunately, I'm not an educator, so I don't want to, you know, riff on education, but I think somehow in schooling, throughout schooling, once I think kids feel like they're not good at science, once that gets in their minds that they struggle with science or math, they do tend to be, people grow up with those from being intimidated to having anxiety around talking about science and math because they're afraid that they'll say something that's perceived as, you know, not being smart or as being wrong. People are always afraid to make mistakes and to sound like they don't understand something or a topic, so they tend to avoid it.
Mm-hmm. And Ruth Lyons, you are an educator. How do you counter that in kids when they hit something hard and get frustrated and feel anxiety around it?
So, and I think that makes a very good point in the importance of like having a growth mindset and how we change how we are looking at science education. And I feel like there's so many different movements right now with, of course, like the STEM initiative, but then also with the makerspaces, and which is a really friendly way for students to interact with sciences. And, you know, I heard someone say that we live in the tutorial generation where everyone can just go on and watch something on YouTube to figure out how it is. And
right.
I think that's really changing what science means. And we need to broaden the definition and allow for experiences and to have these, you know, I call them type ones in my fields, but these opportunities for enrichment like this Maine Science Festival are awesome encounters for students to get excited about science.
Ruth Lyons, you mentioned maker spaces. I work with people who are involved in maker spaces, so I know what this is. But why don't you explain to the general public who has never heard that phrase what a maker space is?
Sure. So, and this has like become one of my favorite things. So a maker space is just so a maker is someone who makes something and shares it, and a maker space can be anything from Legos to, you know, little bits or Arduinos, but then also just even, I mean, I have an elementary makerspace that has nothing more than just some craft materials, you know, and hot glue and, you know, basic tools and scraps of wood, and the kids can just create without innovation, and it really helps to grow that whole, not even a growth mindset, but I feel like that science mindset, because we need to have students understand that in order to create something, it's not a one and done. It's a process, and you often fail at first. And that's the wonderful thing about a makerspace is that it allows that freedom and flexibility for students to be able to try new things and do it without intimidation and take those risks to create something new, because without trying and making things, we never see what could happen. And I mean, if we look back at all of the famous scientists we have, it often started with, you know, 1,000 failures before there was that one thing that worked. So, I like that that's what the maker space movement and the maker movement stands for, is making science fun and, you know, that it's for everyone.
Kate, you started the program by saying the Maine Science Festival is about showing people how science is part of their everyday lives. Excuse me. Can you explain to me what are some ways in which people might not even think of science being part of their everyday lives that you want to sort of pull back the curtain and have them say, aha?
That is a great question. So one example would be wireless networks and phones, right? I mean, I don't think anybody anywhere in Maine probably does not have some type of cell or mobile phone. What we may not realize is all the science that goes and the engineering that goes into making that work, not just in our back pocket, but connecting us to the entire rest of the world, right? So, I for one, couldn't possibly do what I do at the Science Festival without having this computer in my back pocket. So that's one example. And actually, I bring that up because we're going to have a presentation about how do wireless networks work. But another example of the science around us is we are trying very hard to make connections with sciences and the arts for a whole lot of reasons. Number one, the silos are just too it hurts all of us if scientists and artists aren't talking to each other. But artists often use science, even if they don't know it directly. But one of the things that we're going to be looking at this year's festival is science and popular culture, and how has science been represented either well or not as well in things like comic books and television. And, you know, is that critical for everybody's understanding for, you know, a world rewarding life? Maybe not, but it's also really interesting. You know, it's interesting to see how science is represented in comic books in the 1950s and the 1960s and the 70s and 80s and on, and how it reflected what was actually going on in our society at those times. You know, Godzilla was a reflection or an understand, trying to people understand how nuclear weapons might possibly impact us, and it manifested itself that way. So I think there's a lot of different ways, whether it's just us help trying to figure out how the world around us works, literally, or trying to understand how we as a society are moving forward and are using science for that.
So you mean wireless networks aren't just magic?
No, they are not. As much as I love the world of Hogwarts with everyone else, it is apparently a lot in there. So I'm actually really looking forward to that presentation. I'm hoping I can pop in there.
Okay, Ruth, I want to ask you about the whole idea of aptitude. You know, in our culture, we talk a lot about, you know, playing to our strengths. Do I have an aptitude for science? Do I have an aptitude in math? I understand in other cultures that concept is foreign, and there's this feeling that you just work at what you want to do. And how much does that play into kids' idea of whether or not they are able to become scientists or work in science?
So I'm actually right now reading Grit by Angela Duckworth, and it's like a perfect segue to this question, because she talks so much about the grit and so the ability that someone has to stick with something. And, you know, with aptitude, I think aptitude is such a general term or broad term, because you can, you know, aptitude for learning. I think everyone has an aptitude for learning. And I have a very, you know, in the world of gifted education, I feel like I have a very, you know, I think all students have gifts and talents. You know, there's obviously with the bell curve, there's, you know, a spectrum of students that need more assistance in one end, and, you know, and gifted education is the other end of that. But, you know, I think, you know, I look back to just even my education that I received here in Maine and how I was able to go from, you know, I went to the Maine School of Science and Math, where I was able to develop that aptitude because I was around a peer group and a faculty that supported that thinking. And so I feel like when we're playing to strengths, it's also so important to find your tribe or mentor that can help you develop what it is that you're interested in. And, you know, not to be afraid to get stuck in a, you know, like, oh, well, I'm only good at, you know, art. And to think, you know, because I think definitely when Kate was talking about how there's so much science in art, it's so true. I mean, my undergrad's actually in photography, and we actually took chemistry classes, and, you know, I really appreciated that connection between the two. And so allowing students to have this, you know, and again, I'm going to use the word mindset again, but really to think a little bit broader and not think of aptitude in such a narrow, like, content specific way, because I really do feel like, especially in the world that we're living in now, there's so much access to free education and mentors, and, you know, you can get on Twitter and follow authors and, you know, have real conversations that we just didn't have access to before. So I think that that's changing aptitude, and it's, you know, it's an interesting time.
Susan McKay, I'm so glad that you're on the program today, because I suspect that this is a snow day for pretty much every kid in Maine and New Hampshire, and there might be some high school students listening. If a high school student thinks that a career in science is either, okay, I'm going to get a PhD and teach at a university, or maybe I'll be a doctor, or maybe I'll be an engineer, but that's about it, what would you tell that child, and how does your own experience reflect what's available in the world of science?
Well, that's a good question. I was actually thinking about that when Ruth was speaking, that really even the people who work for me at Sierra Helix, it's a broad spectrum of abilities and capabilities that they bring to the table. And when I go into schools in the past, when I've talked to school-age students a lot, I've told them that any career that you're probably going to be involved in when you're in your 30s probably hasn't even been invented yet. And so it's really hard at the, you know, in the K-12 age group to sort of envision a future in science and technology and picture the exact job that you'll actually be undertaking. And it's more important to have sort of embrace your own curiosity and some of the themes we talked about earlier, like, you know, not being afraid to make mistakes, like learning, you know, that's science and progress is built on learning from your mistakes. And so you have to make mistakes to learn from them. And so when in my own job and in my own company, it's really creating that environment, nurturing that environment for people to not be afraid to, you know, to take initiative and to try and figure things out on their own. And so to any high school student, I'd say if you really like sort of, you know, carving out your own job or figuring, you know, if you have the ability and enjoy most directing yourself, like not just being told what to do, but you know, being curious and like trying things and having your own initiative, that a career in the sciences would be perfect, because that's what you need. No, there's no company that I know that wants to hire someone who needs to be told what to do.
I want to throw this out to all three of you. Sort of the perceptions of science in the public. I saw a Pew Research Center poll from a couple years ago that said 79% of people surveyed think that science has made life easier for most people, and 71% think investment in science pays off. But then when you get to hot button topics, whether it's vaccines or climate change or evolution, those numbers go way down. Why?
I'll jump in to start. This is Kate. I think scientists have done a less than stellar job explaining why what they do translates kind of into the general public. And I think it's completely understandable if you spend the last 20 or 30 years of your professional career talking to people who already know your language. It's really hard sometimes to step back from the jargon and the what looks like couching of descriptions of what evidence tells you and just lay something out straight in a way that doesn't sound like you're hedging your bets. I think that's part of it. I think people have this idea that science is magic, and so that it's not based on a foundational aspect of all the little steps that Susan talked about to get there. You know, you try something and you fail, and you try something and this works halfway. And so that if you think something is based on magic, you don't believe that they could possibly know what they're talking about. But if you see how science is done and developed, then you have a much better appreciation for the end result.
A few months ago, we had Steve Curwood from Living on Earth on Maine Calling, and he was talking about the language of scientists, that if scientists are 94% certain, or 94% of scientists agree that, you know, carbon emissions are warming the earth, that's a lot. And that's like about the same as people who believe that smoking is bad for your health. But the general public hears that and thinks, well, 6%, where are the other 6%? And so because scientists are so hesitant to use words like certainty, we're certain of this, that the general public isn't speaking the same language.
Yeah, that goes to scientific training. So this is Susan again. That's really the way you're trained as a scientist. So as you go through, you know, your 8 to 10 years of training after high school to, you know, grow into your field, you're taught to make observations and to, you know, to prove things. And so you can build on, you know, 10, 20, 30 years of experiments that came before you where none of them were a certainty or 100% sure. But obviously as we develop, you know, technology is almost the easy one to point to, because if it works, it works. And so, you know, anything in our phone that's developed, you know, that will enable you to rotate your phone and the image flips around, that's all based on physics. And the physicist who invented that probably didn't say 100% that this is why it works. But the fact that it physically, you can demonstrate that it works, gives people that feeling that, okay, that's a sure thing. But when you talk about things like immunization, or you talk about, you know, evolution, it's hard to point to one specific thing. And so then you're left with the uncertainty of science, and that's the language that people hear, and they'll tend to – and the same thing with global warming. You just use three examples that are – you know, those are things that the proof is going to happen at some future time, and so there's no way to change that language and to show that concrete proof. And I think people outside of science in general just – you know, a lot of people just don't believe something unless they can see it, feel it, and touch it.
We have to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. We're talking about science literacy. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Ocean View at Falmouth, an active retirement community offering independent apartments, cottages, and a care continuum, oceanviewrc.com, and the law offices of Joe Bornstein, a statewide practice representing injured and disabled Mainers since 1974, joebornstein.com.
There's an election this week in the Netherlands, and the themes are pretty clear.
They don't want to integrate, especially the Moroccans. They are a problem. They are a burden.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Nativism, economic populism, and voting in the Netherlands next time on Marketplace.
And you can join us for Marketplace this evening at 6:30. Maine Public is seeking an experienced HR professional to lead all the aspects of our human resources functions for our statewide public broadcasting organization. We're looking for an HR director who's passionate about the work and mission of public broadcasting and has deep experience in all aspects of employee and labor relations, benefit sourcing, performance management, and HR compliance. If you or someone you know has the experience and enthusiasm that would complement Maine Public's dynamic and talented workforce, there's more information and detail on how to apply at our website, mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, what makes people love or hate science, and how important is understanding science in our world today? Joining me from our Bangor studio, Ruth Lyons, the gifted and talented coordinator for RSU 22. Her background is in educational psychology. Susan McKay is the CEO of Sarah Helix in Orono, working on filtration technology. Her background is in chemistry. And Kate Dickerson is the director of the Maine Science Festival, an all-ages event celebrating science that's coming up this weekend. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Mike Berman. He's associate professor at the University of New England, and he's the K-12 outreach coordinator for UNE's Center for Excellence in the Neurosciences. Thanks for joining us, Professor Berman. And how do you work with kids in grades K-12? How do you grab their interest and engage them in science-related topics?
Yeah, thanks, Jennifer, for having me on. I really appreciate it. You know, one of our major areas of focus at the University of New England is making Maine and really the whole world healthier. And what I like to think about is right now, the person who's going to solve Alzheimer's or find a better treatment for addiction exists in the schools. And we just need to spark their interest. We need to convince them that this is an important problem to solve to get them working on it. So we're in the schools all the time. One of the events I want to talk about with you now and your audience is that on Friday, April 7th, we're hosting the University of New England's third annual Brain Fair. It's from 5 to 10 p.m. It's open to the public, and there'll be a number of amazing activities for the public to engage in.
All right, and I'm going to invite you to post something on our Maine Calling Facebook page about the Brain Fair. What is that spark, though? I think a lot of kids find science to be hard. How do you help them overcome that sort of fear of doing something that doesn't come easily?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what we try and do is make it fun. So our program brings out materials like brains they can dissect, or we bring insects that they can work with, and we can show them in small groups with the materials that we can provide how addiction works, or what they can track the pathways of the brain by which visual information gets from our eyes into what we call our cortex and helps us perceive. And the kids, when they can get hands-on, they can work in small groups, they can work with our medical students or our neuroscience students, I think they find it more fascinating than hard, to be honest.
All right. Well, is your event on April 7th at the Biddeford campus or in Portland?
It's on our Biddeford campus at the Harold Elfond Forum. We typically have hundreds, sometimes thousands of people come, and we're excited to have your audience.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling. Mike Berman is with UNE. He is assistant professor and outreach coordinator for the Center for Excellence in the Neurosciences. We're going to move to some other calls now. Gordon in Raymond. Hi, Gordon. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks very much. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I work with my specialization area is dealing with people with anxiety. I have been, so a piece of what I recognized is that as I've worked with people in therapy, I realized that a part of what I help them do is some of the stuff that I've heard, like Kate was talking about trying to say, look, science, what we do in science, not just the actual scientific method, is part of what I help patients learn to do to help them get over their anxiety, to have the willingness to take risks. I think it was Sue who was talking about the importance of being able to make mistakes. and be okay with that, and that if you make a mistake, that it doesn't mean it's going to be something you're going to get pounded for or criticized or whatever. And that making mistakes is part of how we work in the world. And as I've been doing this, I came to realize that to me, it seems that what I want to do is try to help move beyond the idea of science being important just for scientists or people who are going into science. I like what Kate was talking about making it about for everyday things. Everybody benefits from thinking scientifically, from being able to take a look at things and recognize that we have these flaws in the way we think that science helps protect ourselves from. And I think that all too often we end up with getting stuck in the idea that science is for scientists and that when we think of science, we think of the products, not the process.
Mm-hmm. Gordon, and thanks so much for your call. I want to turn your comments to our panel. Do you all have thoughts on Gordon's comments?
Well, this is Susan. I definitely agree that science isn't just for scientists, and I think he's right. I think people benefit from just approaching all sorts of – I mean, science is really about problem solving, and so obviously scientists aren't the only people in the world who have to solve problems. So I think the scientific method has a lot to teach really anybody about becoming more successful.
Gordon, thanks for your call. I'm going to move to Portland and Ashley. Hi, Ashley. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello there.
Go ahead.
Hi. So kind of related to this, I was calling to discuss or bring up and have you guys discuss the role that a foundation in the arts, particularly literature in all its forms, provides to maybe those who do have this aptitude for sciences and math and whatnot, but really to provide this foundation and give a platform to be able to think creatively and articulate, you know, these, you know, complex scientific and mathematical, you know, whatever it is, the what they're trying to, you know, prove in whatever science they're.
Sure, a lot of creativity in science, and I'll send that up to our panel. When you're trying to solve a problem, you have to find creative ways to research it. I'm thinking about some of the recent books I've read about. We had a psychologist on last week who's written a book called, I believe it's called, What Emotions Are Made Of, and how to test where people's how people think about emotion, how people perceive of things. You have to be really creative to even come up with the tests.
Yes. So, you know, with the literature, you know, I sort of think about that, and it's a nice, I think, all, you know, with the aspect of different books and, you know, with some of the young adult novels that are coming out now, there is much more of a role of especially girls in science, which I think is awesome. And then, you know, even with like Hidden Figures coming out, I think that movie in particular has done a lot for the field of, I don't want to say unlocking, because that's, but, you know, showing how science has, you know, women have always played a role in science and that it's been an important role. And I think for especially young girls, I think about some of the girls I work with in middle school who are really excited about that book and, you know, were sort of astonished that they had not heard of that before and were really sort of frustrated by that and have sort of taken it on as their mission to see what other women scientists are hidden, which, you know, I love that idea. And I think that this is, you know, and that is what literature can do. Granted, yes, Hidden Figures was based on a book, everyone. So, you know, I think that it does, like, literature could be that first unlocking moment for a child. And, you know, so I think that, as Ashley's saying, literature could be one way, and it does allow students to, anyone, even myself, you know, to think more complexly and to make connections. So it's a great sort of asset to this, to scientific thinking.
Ashley, thanks for your call. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. This is Kate. I think it's really been easy for the last 20 or 30 or 40 years to have this break, idea that you do science only or you do humanities only. And the truth is that there are an awful lot of people who are either interested in both or who are really good at explaining one or the other. So, you know, for example, there's a lot of really great plays about science, and very few of those playwrights necessarily have a science degree, but they know how to do creative thinking, they know how to do research, and they're then able to bring that science story alive in front of a whole audience, and they're using the arts to do that. And that's where we come from with the Science Festival, with trying to explain that you don't have to be the one necessarily doing the science, but you can be the one helping to make the understanding of science a little bit better, but you can also be celebrating kind of what it does and the people who do it. So the people who are doing the science may not be the ones who can explain why it's so exciting, but other people can. And that's important. I think the more scientists and artists mix and match with each other, the better off we all are.
Well, we'll go. Go ahead.
So this year for the Maine Science Festival, they had a mock trailer contest, and I loved it. And so basically the students had to make a 2-minute mock trailer.
Like a movie trailer?
With a scientific theme. A movie trailer, mm-hmm. Yeah. And it really forced, I mean, here we're talking about creative thinking and complex thinking, and it forced that, you know, and creative thinking is forcing two unlike things together, and that's exactly what this did. And you know, it was really fun. I had my students do it, and it was really fun for them to think about a science topic and then put it into like a romance or a horror, or, you know, horror was a very popular one, or a comedy or a musical, you know. So it was that was such complex thinking. And it was, and so, you know, just another shout out to something that is happening this weekend, and you'll be able to view some of those.
The winners will be revealed on Sunday.
Oh, great. So we're going to go up to Waterville and Ellery. Hi, Ellery. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. I think I have a PhD in practical and helpful designs. I'm an engineer, so I can talk about why stairs are built the way they are, why a car door slams harder when the window is closed versus when it's open, why snow drifts occur, why there's a center of gravity issue with how we shovel snow. I can talk about physiology, meteorology, geology. I love science. Now, my question is, how do we keep, and your panelists have talked about the issues of making science interesting and practical, but how do we keep that from pre-K all the way through college? Because if you don't keep that zest, that interest going, it's easy to lose track. And I enjoy science, and that's always been a part of my makeup. But how do we instill that zest, that passion through all sciences? Why shouldn't a chemist talk to an engineer? And why shouldn't a neuroscientist talk to a chemist or an electrical engineer? I mean, there's crosstalk possibilities that keep the enthusiasm going. And I don't see enough of a desire or a need to have these folks talk to one another, because all sciences relate to one another to one degree or another. And I don't see that being a theme of keeping the science forefront all the way from kindergarten all the way up through and keep that passion going.
Okay, so I'm going to give our panel a chance to respond. Go ahead.
So this is Ruth. I think that that's how do we keep the zest alive? You know, passion is common, endurance is rare, you know, and I think with, you know, this is where that grit comes into play. And, you know, what research says is we need to find mentors, like someone who can demonstrate to us how to become that person and what deliberate practice it is we need to become an expert, a coach, so to speak. So, you know, I think that this is where those connections are so important. And I think all fields, I mean, I was just down in D.C. this past weekend for a conference on gifted education. And we were talking about how in the field we need to make connections with science, with, you know, different things. And I think, you know, I'm hearing it here, too. And I think that's just the way where our world is going, is everything is becoming connected, and a large part due to technology. So I think that we need to be making those intersections more often to allow students to see that it's not just one thing.
Ellery, thanks for your call. We're going to move on to Constantino, who's calling from Westbrook. Hi, Constantino. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. Love your show.
Thank you.
My question is to your esteemed panel is, how do we promote science, technology, mathematics, et cetera, to our children when we live in a climate where our president scoffs at the scientific community, appoints climate deniers to cabinet positions, and has indeed appointed somebody to the Department of Education who has no educational experience?
Well, I mean, I think the best way to promote science and to your children is, you know, children are born natural scientists. They go out, if they're outside and they're interested, you know, it's really just encouraging their curiosity about the world around them and answering all their questions. And if you can talk to them about what's going on in D.C. or in politics. And, you know, the best way to encourage someone in the scientific method is to encourage them to ask questions and not get frustrated as a parent they're endlessly asking questions. So that's one way. And I think the more kids can participate in science and technology without being graded. So there's so many opportunities in the state of Maine in the summer for kids to be involved in camps and programs where it's just for fun. And the more they're exposed to different ways of thinking where they don't have to have the anxiety of having a grade, the better off they'll be.
We do have to go to another. Go ahead. Okay. Ruth, go ahead. And if you could be quick because we got to go to a break.
Yep, it will be quick. I was just going to say, like, just to piggyback on what Susan was saying, is that there's so many opportunities here in Maine. I think we often think that we live in a rural state that's disconnected. But, I mean, when I moved from urban areas as New York City and in Hartford, I felt like, oh, I'm going to Maine and or moving back to Maine. And I think that that's what the young generation always is thinking. But I'm amazed at what is available just in this Bangor area for STEM outreach and opportunities.
Well, we do have to take a break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Mills Entertainment, presenting Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood live at Merrill Auditorium this Thursday, March 16th. Tickets and details at porttix.com.
In 2007, Al Gore wrote a best-selling critique of what he saw as the Bush administration's attack on truth. He's updated it for the Trump era.
American democracy is in grave danger from the changes in the environment in which ideas either live and spread or wither and die.
Our conversation with Al Gore this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us and Nora Flaherty for All Things Considered, getting underway at 4 o'clock this afternoon. And join us at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling for World Affairs. Today, career ambassador and expert on U.S.-China and Middle East relations, Chaz W. Freeman, discusses your U.S. foreign policy, laying out a roadmap for how we can remain competitive in an increasingly disorderly world. That's World Affairs coming up after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, science literacy and its importance in navigating today's world. Joining me today, Susan McKay, who is CEO of Sarah Helix, Kate Dickerson, director of the Maine Science Festival, and Ruth Lyons, gifted and talented coordinator for RSU 22. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. I want to go to an email now from Kelly. Please speak to the way the emphasis on standardized testing in the areas of literacy and math at the elementary level have squeezed out science and social studies. I teach middle school science, and many incoming grade 6 students have had little experience with science, perhaps a half hour a week. I hope this will change.
And, you know, so this is Ruth, obviously, right in my little cabinet here. So, and I think that this is where, as educators, we need to stop thinking of science as like this standalone content area. And really, I mean, science is everywhere. You know, so and this is where we can bring it into STEM. And I think that, I mean, STEM, obviously, I was thinking makerspaces and said the wrong word. Makerspaces and just having a corner in a room where students can create in that scientific process, you know, or design process or engineering process, whichever one you want to choose, all contribute to the same type of thinking, and it's the scientific thinking. And I think that having just an area where students can create and explore is way more science than we would think. And if we can have students, even if they don't have access to, let's say, a standard science course, if we can get them in grade 6 being flexible thinkers, that would be you know, not just as good, but it would be a step in the right direction. So, you know, and then also just finding creative ways to fit things in. I know in education we're always trying to fit one more thing in. So you know, might be a little bit cliche to say that. But, you know, also then just promoting the things that are going on in our community that can happen on the weekends. And, you know, I think in education, sometimes educators try to be the everything for students. And we really have to relay to parents some of the great opportunities that are going on outside of school hours, of the things that are happening, like the Maine Science Festival. This could be a great opportunity for students to become interested and engaged. And once they're hooked on something, you know, it's amazing that as what passion will do for a student as to what they'll pick up and read or explore or watch. So
I have an email from Diane. I think you guys are going to like this one. Diane writes, I hated science in school, avoided it at all costs. I just couldn't see how it affected my daily life. As an adult, I'm a dairy farmer in Maine, and my whole life is now about science, animal science and raising my dairy herd, making cheese. It's all science. Who knew? If we relate science to what we do every day, it takes the science out of it and allows us to see it as fun. Maybe, Kate, you might want to invite Diane to the science fair this weekend.
I was just thinking, I've got a whole panel set up for her for next year, I think. She just sounds like right up our alley.
I'm going to go to Portland and Patricia. Hi, Patricia. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Great show. I'm an artist, and I always felt that scientists and artists think the same way and push the envelope in tackling problems. And I became a jewelry designer because it's applied physics, it's art, and it's math, three things that I loved. And jewelry making has metallurgy, geology, engineering, chemistry, applied math, weights and measures, formulas for figuring out things, and art. And most people see the art part of it and don't see the science part of it, which is just huge, you know? So I just keep doing what you're doing. I think it's great. And the more that it can be made understanding that it is in our lives every day is huge.
Patricia, thanks for your call. I'm going to move on to an email from Bob. He writes, as a science teacher for 30 years, I've found that many people believe something on a visceral level, learned from their family values and through religion. Science is often thought of as the opposite of religion. Science requires proof. Religion is based on faith. Accepting science means giving up on core values. Simply showing data and even proof is not enough for them to give up on their faith. We must find a way, maybe through religion, to convince people to reassess those values and make them relevant to today's needs. That climate change is still being questioned and evolution thought of as only possible tells me that we educators are not succeeding in this quest. Thoughts?
Well, this is Ruth. The researcher in me now wants to do like a qualitative study about people who are in religion. But, you know, I have to say in my field, and this is totally a personal observation, I have to say I feel like people who are religious have the ability to develop abstract thinking sooner. And I think in some of the years that I've been in gifted education doing identification, and I don't know if there's a correlation here, but I often would see the students that were identified were also students who I would see in church every weekend. And I often wondered if there was any type of ability to think abstractly and then be a more flexible thinker. And it's unfortunate to see that could be a negative aspect on science, because I think that those are the type of thinkers we need in science. And I don't really think that, you know, I think that hopefully is a small minority, because there's, again, like the whole uncertainty of science also is in religion as well. So, I mean, that could probably be a whole other Maine Calling topic right there. So
that happens a lot.
Susan, I would just add to that, you know, one way to connect with people is to find something they can relate to. And there's plenty of people in science who are also very religious. And you can share actual stories of famous scientists who had religion informed a lot of, you know, their pursuit of science. And it's also true that scientists have to have a lot of faith. So, you know, I do product development. And, you know, you have to really believe that you're going to get there in the end. And I think if you can relate the way they feel and think to the way a scientist feels and thinks, and if you can relate that people can be religious and still believe in science, that and that's all you can do. You can only, you know, try to connect with them at some level, and people have to come to their own conclusions.
We're going to go to Blue Hill and Corey. Hi, Corey. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to make a comment where I think part of the solution comes in how we train and educate our scientists. I have a background in wildlife biology, and when I was in school, my hardest professor was adamant that I needed to have back-of-the-envelope knowledge, that I needed to be able to sit down with Grandma and explain to her everything I did and knew without jargon or $5 terms. And in a world where we see people in front of Congress and 140 characters at a time, I think it's really important for scientists to be able to say what they do and reach out to others.
Sure. Translators.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Corey, thanks for your call. Megan on Facebook says, you've spoken about the importance of adult science literacy as well. You're going to like this question, Kate. Are there any opportunities for non-graded experiences for adults in science in Maine?
I think there are about 60-plus events just this weekend that people can come that are not graded. What Corey just said in his last caller about, back of the envelope, no $5 words, that's the entire festival. We ask our presenters, who are many of whom literally are rock star scientists in their field, to come and talk to us. Not talking down to us, but just assume that we have the vocabulary and the language of someone who has high school science. And our presenters are astounding, and they do a phenomenal job. So we have literally over 60 events and activities planned for the weekend that adults can take part in, none of which are graded, none of which you have to answer any questions about, almost all of which I would hazard a guess that you'll have a great time at.
Okay. Here's an email from Jean. She writes, Jean in Belfast, it's more basic than science. People need to be taught earlier in school how to tell the truth versus fiction. For example, yesterday I got a call from my cousin who just spent $150 on a day-long workshop on how to treat Lyme disease with herbs and nutrition. She was so excited to tell me that, quote, the Lyme virus was really dangerous because it's closely related to malaria. I have a PhD in microbiology, and I'm a physician assistant, so aware of scientific method and up to date on diseases. Not to mention the confusion of people on what's true or false in politics these days, such as the statistical chance of being killed by a Muslim refugee. What is it? One in a billion?
Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah, we all. Yeah.
Okay, if we could see you, just... you'd be nodding, right?
Okay. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to move
actually, that brings up.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, in general, I think all we really need to teach people is a basic understanding of statistics.
Yes.
And we'd be a lot better off.
We're going to move to Portland and Elias. Hi, Elias. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you for a wonderful show this afternoon. I just wanted to add, I think, a helpful anecdote adding on to what the gentleman a few callers ago said about different scientific fields cross-pollinating with each other. And I don't know if any of you folks are familiar with Dr. Robert Schock, who's he's a geologist, a PhD geologist at Boston University. But 20 years ago, he was invited by a Egyptologist to come and look at some interesting evidence around the Sphinx enclosure, which showed that the Sphinx might be very, very, very much older than mainstream Egyptology talks about. And he looked at the Sphinx enclosure and saw that the walls of the enclosure were showed signs of weathering from extensive rain. And that period of that area of the world, at one point before it was desert, was a rainforest jungle area. And that was 10,000 years before they say that the Sphinx was actually built. So the Sphinx itself shows the same kind of weathering. And now it's accepted, more or less, on the scientific fields. That's how old the Sphinx and the enclosure around it are. But even today, mainstream Egyptology won't accept that because it came from a non-Egyptologist. But other geologists and archaeologists from outside of Egypt all agree. So I just wanted to add that anecdote and say that sometimes looking at things with a fresh pair of eyes can reveal some surprising information.
Thanks, Elias. I take it you all would agree.
Yes.
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 Okay, thanks for your call. We'll go to Lisbon and Haley. Hi, Haley. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? I'm so excited. I am so happy you guys are talking about this. I also want to add, I'm so excited that it's a panel of women. How cool is that? And I wanted to just talk about myself as a student. When I was in school, I was so bad at math, and I hated science. I felt like I was really bad at it, which discouraged me from wanting to learn. But now in my position as an adult, in my workplace, we use science every day, and we use math every day. And the change for me was, as a student, what it always was here's a question, let's talk about finding the answer. And what changed for me as an adult is it was more so, what kind of questions do you have? What sparks your curiosity? And we got to ask the questions and find the solution to a question that might not already have an answer. And I wanted to hear, might any of you agree that it's not just about making it fun, but it's about making sure that kids are curious, because curiosity is really what sparks discovery. And that might be something that's missing in the educational approach to science.
Go ahead.
I definitely agree. I mean, this is Susan. I have to confess, both my kids went to Montessori school through eighth grade, and that was really how science was presented to them. It was really interesting for me to watch them grow up in that educational system, very different from me. I'd done all public school, and seeing how science was taught in the Montessori curriculum was very eye-opening, because it was very much about process, which is really fundamentally what science is about. And it's about, you know, just being curious and just trying things out and building something and seeing if it works. So,
and I also, this is Ruth. I think that math fear or anxiety that we see so often is paralyzing. But I often think that, you know, my best friend is a kindergarten teacher and she has huge math anxiety, I just don't see it, because I've seen her teach, and she's like the world's best teacher, quite honestly. And to see her teach math concepts to kindergartners, you would never know that there's this math anxiety. And so I often think that having other people witness what you're doing and be in a collaborative environment can also help bring that down, so you get out of your own head. Because a lot of times there's many ways to look at one problem.
Okay.
And I think that...
Ruth, that's good. Yep, I'm going to have to cut you off because we're out of time. Thank you so much. That was Ruth Lyons, an educator with RSU 22. Kate Dickerson was also with us, the director of the Maine Science Festival, which is kicking off this Thursday evening in Bangor. And Susan McKay, a chemist and CEO of Sarah Helix. John Keimel ran the board today. Special thanks to George Thomas and Rich Tozier in Bangor. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.